My main advice is always get to know your yard, get to know your outside world, and start listening and exploring. I think one interesting aspect of the pandemic was that more people became birders than at any other point in time, because when the world quieted down, even my own sister said, "There's this orange bird nesting on my front porch." It was a robin. It said it wasn't an orange bird, but that's what she called it. But it's people started noticing what was around them. And the more that we can engage with the world around us, the more that we start caring. We start caring about that dove that's nesting. What happened to its eggs? Why is it not nesting here anymore, et cetera. And the more that we can really connect with nature again, we will connect with ourselves, and we will care more and ideally make better decisions long term.
Welcome. I'm David Castro, board member of the Alliance of Leadership Fellows. Today, the Alliance is excited to continue a series of national conversations engaging leaders at the frontiers of social justice. Our conversation today concerns the climate crisis, with a focus on the loss of biodiversity, which now threatens not only human communities around the world, but also the ecosystems that support all life on Earth. Our series is called Talk That Walks. Our program convenes frontline leaders at the critical place where thought becomes change. The leaders in today's dialogue inhabit the transition point where experience and insight take flight as impactful action. We want to thank the Americana Foundation for supporting today's conversation. To learn more about the vision and mission of the Alliance, visit us on the web at allianceofleadershipfellows.org. I'm passing the baton now to Daniel Katz. Daniel is a leading global environmental activist. He's the founder of the renowned Rainforest Alliance and also serves as the lead environmental advisor to the Overbrook Foundation. He's also a Kellogg Foundation National Leadership Fellow. Daniel will be your guide for the rest of this event.
Well, thank you, David, and nice to be here. I'm especially excited today because we're going to be talking about biodiversity. And biodiversity is the reason that I got involved in conservation like 40 some years ago at this point now. It's crazy. And with me today are two amazing people, scientists. One is Viviana Ruiz Gutierrez she's an ornithologist at Cornell, and there's many other titles that they both have, but I'm just going to go short and we'll talk about the other ones. And we also have Mary Blair, who is a conservation biologist and a primatologist at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Both are in New York. So welcome and thank you for joining me this afternoon. It's really a pleasure. So I obviously we're going to talk about biodiversity and the climate crisis and how they're linked and things that people can do. But I would love to get started by hearing a little bit about how you both got interested and involved in your areas, because you're both doing amazing work in related yet totally different areas. So Viviana, can you go first and just give us a little bit of a background?
Yeah, so I'm from Costa Rica. And I know that many people have been down there on trips. And it's hard to grow up in Costa Rica and not have an interest in biodiversity. From when you're little, you're taken on field trips to national parks, and you really are surrounded by a plethora of just richness and monkeys and green spaces and everything else. And it's when I was really young, I wanted to know, I heard all about how Costa Rica was a conservation leader. And I didn't know what that word meant, and I didn't know what we were conserving. And so that's kind of how where my interest was sparked into becoming a conservationist and working to protect biodiversity.
And can you just say a little bit more about what you're doing now? And I know you're a PhD, and what that PhD is in.
Yeah, so I originally wanted to be a vet, actually. but when I was younger, in high school, I really realized that being outside and understanding the natural world, that's what a scientist did. And so, a lot of times we think scientists are in a laboratory, but when I realized that a scientist is outside and they're working in with biodiversity and with different animals, I decided to go for a PhD, but I studied tropical biology in Costa Rica first. But another unique aspect is I'm also a quantitative ecologist, because you can't just study the animals and not know how they're doing. And so what I found out was if you know statistics, you can actually almost speak for the birds that you're studying and other critters that you're studying.
That's really amazing. And that sounds really hard. That quantitative part, that just scares me right there. The bird part's really interesting. Mary, how about you?
Yeah, so, well, I want to thank you, Daniel, and also David and Viviana for asking me to join today. And I want to give thanks to my ancestors and my family and the stewards of this land that make it possible for me to be with you today. And so how did this start for me? Well, one aspect is that my ancestors and extended family are actually Sami nomadic reindeer herders who today live north of the Arctic Circle in Sweden and Norway, some of whom migrated to Alaska. And then that is how I came to be here with you. And I hope to have the chance to tell you more about that later, but my connections with them inspire me every day to lean into this critical work at the intersection of the biodiversity crisis and the climate change crisis. But more specifically about, you know, how my scientific interests arose. Early on, I think it was in high school, I became really interested in like human evolution and Neanderthals. And I was like, wow, like how did they exist and how did we become ourselves? And that got me into primatology and learning about monkeys and primates. And in college, I was looking for an opportunity to study abroad that would satisfy my interest in primatology and also somewhere where they spoke Spanish because I spoke Spanish. And I settled on Costa Rica, which we've already talked about today. And I spent a semester in Costa Rica doing an internship, learning about primate conservation and conservation in Costa Rica. And it was very quick for me, the change in my research interests from, you know, thinking about fossils in the past to what is happening right now. I ended up doing an internship looking at a critically endangered species of squirrel monkey in Costa Rica. I was talking to different NGOs that were really interested in conserving this species, but they were lacking a critical piece of information that could help them do what they wanted to do. And I was like a dog with a bone. I was like, I am going to write a grant. I'm going to write this grant. I'm going to go do a PhD and answer this question for you. And that's what I ended up doing. And I haven't looked back. My PhD is in ecology and evolutionary biology. And I was really very lucky, I realize now, to have had this kind of collaboration and partnership with a conservation practitioner from the beginning of the project, such that my scientific results plugged into a specific on-the-ground action, you know, right away. And that was so lucky, and it now is like the guiding thread for everything I do. And I'm addicted to that, to doing action-based research for conservation.
Wow. And later on, we'll, or sooner, we're going to talk about, we have to talk about the slow loris because it's such
a... Yes, of course.
So Viviana, a few months ago, I saw you give the most amazing talk and slide presentation in Washington. And what I mean, there were so many highlights to it, but one of the things that you talked about, I think, was community conservation, getting people who lived in the area where you're working involved and trying to figure out how they can help conserve bird species and biodiversity in general. Can you just say a little bit more about that work?
Yeah, and it ties a little bit to that concept that you mentioned, science to action. So we really, I lead the conservation science program at the Cornell Lab, and that's really what's behind that program, science to action. But the kind of additional layer that we have with our work is that we involve people in that science. So it's that concept called community science. And really, whenever we work with the public, we try to say that science is just another way of learning, that they're learning in their own way every day. And so when they're learning with us and helping us collect data, that's what makes them scientists and they're community scientists. So most of the data that I use, birds, come from people. And so we have, you know, almost 2 billion records in our world database, and it all comes from people. And so entering their observations, telling us what birds they see in their yards, telling us when they see those birds, exactly where, and we really learn with them. And so when we generate results about what's happening to bird populations or what's happening to biodiversity around them, or for example, in their coffee farm, they collected that data. It's not us telling them top down what's happening. They're part of that process. And when we really involve people in collecting that information, they can also be part of the solution. So for example, like you said, when our research turns into actions, they're part of those actions. They're not coming from an unknown place because they helped collect the data. So that adds just kind of a unique dimension to science to action work when we're able to involve the public in that way.
Do you think it turns them into stewards? I mean, if when you work with someone or someone's on the ground or living in a neighborhood or a community and they collect some of the data, do you get that they start to inherit a sense of pride and a desire to maintain those species in those natural areas?
I think it's a little bit of both, because a lot of times what we do is validate the stewardship that they're doing already. And other times, so, you know, one example is one of the coffee farmers we work with. They already knew that they didn't want to cut down dead trees, because those dead trees, what he called them, were parrot condominiums. And so he said, you know, those are the parrot condominiums right there. So what's really exciting for us is to be able to say, you are correct. And now what we can do is take that information, and that's the reason that we see these parrots in your farm, because you take those actions. And we don't see them in other coffee farms because they're cutting down all of the dead trees. There aren't places for them. So, you know, it really validates a bit of the effort that they put into that otherwise a lot of times goes unseen versus other actions that maybe somebody else is measuring. But at the same time, one of the things that we have done with the communities we work with is a nest photo contest. And we did a nest photo contest, bird nest, many other than bird nest photo contest. And what a lot of the farmers, coffee farmers that we work with notice is that there are a lot of nests in their coffee farm, in their coffee plants themselves too, and in their farms. So they start seeing and they're like, oh, we can't prune at this time right now. Is there another time that we can prune? Because there's all these nests everywhere. So one of the most common species that nests in coffee plants is the rufous-tailed hummingbird. And so we get many pictures of that hummingbird nesting on the coffee plants. And so they also become more aware of, oh, before this contest, before I had to give you that data too, I wasn't paying attention to all these nests. And so I think it's a little bit of both, validating their efforts and then getting them to see different things.
So why are they called parrot condominiums and not hummingbird condominiums? Or owl condominiums? Well,
the coffee plants can be the hummingbird condominiums, but like the emerald toucanet also nests in dead trees. And so they, you know, unless it poses a safety hazard, they really start thinking, you know, just like I need a home. They need a home, and really a big message is what's good and healthy for you is also good and healthy for birds. Yeah. So the more that you see, that means that the farm is also healthy for your children and your family. It becomes kind of cohesive that way.
Yeah, that's really powerful. I wish we could translate that globally, because it's such an important message. Mary, what about in your work? How are you involving communities?
Yes, well, I think, Yeah, I'm just loving this conversation because I think what we're saying is really resonating with each other. I think what I found that really works for me in my work at the Center for Biodiversity and Conservation at the museum is that collaboration and partnership with diverse communities from the start, so from the inception of a project, is what really works to translate our science and scientific research into action. And what that looks like is, you know, equitable collaboration, creating space to talk and to listen, including decision makers and practitioners from the very beginning. And it takes work, it takes time, and it takes work. And because sometimes we may be speaking the same language, even if it's not English, but meaning different things. And so it can take a long time to sort of understand each other and listen deeply and make sure there's equitable contributions in the design of something. And this kind of work, it takes longer than more like scientific parachute style sort of projects, but they really pay off in the long run in terms of impact. So an example about the Slow the Wars work in Vietnam, as you requested, Daniel, would be that we have a couple of projects in Vietnam with longtime partners there, partnerships that started, you know, in the 90s when our countries first reopened to collaboration with each other. And these are on the topics of primate conservation, especially slow lorises, which are nocturnal primates, who are also toxic/poisonous, which maybe you can just Google that. I won't get into it. And also related to that, the biggest threat to slow lorises is wildlife trade. So we also had a big project about wildlife trade, illegal wildlife trade, and the impact of that on biodiversity in Vietnam and in Southeast Asia. And because these projects were co-created and collaborative deeply from the start with decision makers and practitioners in Vietnam, our findings immediately fed into important government decisions at the national level, such as the Prime Minister's Action Plan for Primate Conservation, which included recommendations and key steps to take to control wildlife trade, identified hotspots of trade activities, species under pressure, and recommendations for rescue and release. And it also, you know, because of that, got a lot of attention regionally, inspiring work in other countries. It's informed USAID's funding priorities. And something that I'm especially proud of is that it led to a revision of Vietnam's forensic law, such that wildlife is now under the jurisdiction of that law, which means that they've had more successful prosecutions against illegal trafficking of wildlife. So it, you know, that really wouldn't have been possible if we hadn't taken the time and made that space at the beginning to collaborate and design the project intentionally with that in mind.
Did you think when you started in this field, studying species, that so much of your work was going to involve having to work with human beings? Mary, what do you think? Was that part of the plan? Or I mean, did you know that at the time? Or did you feel like, wow, in order to get stuff done, I am going to have to work with people?
You know, it's certainly not what we learn in a PhD in biology, I would say. So it came as a surprise that I had to learn those skills on the fly, I would say. And I think it would probably help biodiversity conservation if conservation science PhD students got a little bit more interdisciplinary training or people skills training, because it is a huge part of this work. Would definitely agree with that.
Yeah, you know, so I've been working in conservation for a long time now. When I first got involved in trying to study rainforest, I was looking for people like you, both of you, who were doing this work. So, you know, when I would find an article, even though I wasn't a scientist, about if it was about birds or a slow loris, you know, I got so excited. And you both back then and now are like my heroes, because you are doing the, what I think is the most important work on the planet. You know, and I think about like who we lift up in society, it's so backwards, because the work that you both are doing is so fantastic and so important. And Viviana, when you got involved in this work and did you know that you were going to be dealing with the world's greatest environmental crisis? Or did you think, I love birds?
You know, I saw a lot of habitat change in Costa Rica when I was an undergrad, as I was studying tropical biology. So even just from my house, growing up, I would wake up and I would hear birds sing. North of my house and central Costa Rica, north of there is just coffee farms full of trees. And by the time I was in college, it was all urban, you know, and it was these urbanizations that have no trees, because a lot of people link trees with crime. So if you have a lot of trees nearby, that means that burglars might come near your house. So there's a big push for a lot of urban development in tropical countries to just be bare a lot of times, to not have native trees, not keep kind of native landscaping. And so I saw a lot of that change as an undergrad, and even remembered some of the places where I would go camping and off of the coast had become big hotels and big resorts. And so in the back of my mind, that was actually my motivation. I loved birds, but that was the motivation. The birds that I grew up seeing, I wasn't seeing anymore. And so I felt that if I didn't join kind of the good cause, then I was not going to see any more birds, and neither was for any of my family, my future family. And that was at the back of my mind always as a motivation.
Yeah, I think I may have asked you this question when you were giving that great slideshow, but if you had, you know, a gazillion dollars right now to conserve biodiversity, how do you think you would spend it? What do you think we can do?
You know, most scientists would say more data, but I also did my PhD in an ecology evolution biology department, and I was kind of a complete outlier, because I say, we have the information that we need. I think that what I would love to do is to come up with more cross-sectoral solutions and really empower people where they're not empowered. So I greatly believe that a lot of that money, if we spend it in country and really in implementing solutions that are coming from those places, we would do a lot more than investing, for example, in kind of more, not Western approaches, but if we only invest those funds in research and people that are not living in the places where the crises are happening, that are not in Brazil. I was lucky enough to come to the US to get my PhD, but I remember that every bright young mind that I studied with didn't get that opportunity. They either had to support their families, but they have better ideas than me. They can do 20 more things than I can do. And so I would really invest in research and capacity building dollars across sectors to really work on solutions that could really kind of shift the needle in what's happening today.
Can you give it, like, is there an example that you could give that you think would be helpful?
Yes. So I helped create, with the support of the Packard Foundation, a fellowship program at Cornell to develop coastal solutions. It's called Soluciones Costeras. And it brings together civil engineers, shorebird scientists, landscape architects, and it brings them together under one fellowship to really come up with solutions. So to protect our coastal habitats for people and for birds as well. You know, shorebirds have declined terribly since the 1970s. I know a lot of folks have heard that we've lost 3 billion birds since the 1970s, and shorebirds are one of the groups that has declined the steepest. So I developed this fellowship program about 6 years ago, and now we have close to 24 fellows that have gone through the program. And so, for example, one fellow in Chile, Flavio, what he has done is he has worked with the government in Chile to help modify the law so that you can declare urban wetlands an actual protected area that gets managed. And so right now he helped develop it with the science that would help guide which wetlands are beneficial for birds, which ones would help the hydrology of these urban areas. And now there's several hundred wetlands that are being protected thanks to his work. That's just one of many examples that we
need to get more money in there. Mary, what would you do? You've got a gazillion dollars to spend. How would you like to spend it in conservation and to protect biodiversity?
Yeah, I mean, I have to echo Viviana. I think our biggest opportunity and our biggest challenge moving forward is this human rights angle on biodiversity conservation. We have this huge opportunity to partner with Indigenous and local communities on these efforts and really invest in that. Because the statistics are out there. I think in our community, this is well known and respected, but I'll repeat them for the audience. Indigenous communities make up less than 5% of the world population and protect about 80% of the Earth's biodiversity and give or take 30% of the Earth's land, which they have lived in and stewarded for centuries. And studies are showing they do just as good a job of conserving biodiversity, if not better, than, you know, gazetted protected areas, as recognized by the UN World Conservation Monitoring Center. I was at the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues last week, and this is a really important forum where we've been talking about biodiversity and climate change for decades at this forum. But only just last year did the Global Biodiversity Framework formally recognize how important the role is of Indigenous peoples and local communities in these efforts for biodiversity because of the strenuous work of the Indigenous Caucus at the Kunming-Montreal Framework Agreement. So that is the huge opportunity we have. There are some funding mechanisms in place to try and get the huge amount of money that is pledged by countries into implementing the biodiversity framework. But there are some new projects that are trying to make sure that money goes to Indigenous and local communities and recognizes those efforts in addition to others. And so I would fund those. That's what I would do if I had a gazillion dollars.
What do you think? I guess I'll ask you both this. What do you think of the E.O. Wilson plan and some others to set aside 30% or 50% of the world's land and water for conservation? I mean, I was going to use the word, I use the word conservation. I don't use the word preservation, right? I don't know how you both feel about the word preservation, but I feel like it's not realistic and it's not how the world would work. But is that, do you think that's realistic that we can set aside a large chunk of the earth in order to conserve biodiversity in wild spaces? Viviana, what do you think?
You know, if it is conserved or co-managed versus preserved, like you said, you know, a great example of what you said, Mary, is the Mayan Biosphere Reserve, and another Rainforest Alliance has done a lot of work there where people manage their forestry concessions. Those are the ones that are protected. When people are empowered to manage their land that they want to pass down, and they want to pass down those resources. So if we can support that management of 30% of the land, if we can support community forests. So even in Costa Rica and Guanacaste, where my grandfather had a farm a long time ago, most farmers set aside chunks of forests. They knew that having forests on their land was important. And a lot of times several landowners would get together and they would preserve a larger chunk of forest together. And so I think facilitating, it depends on how that 30% is set aside. Is it in private reserves? Is it in community managed reserves? Is it, if it really is something that is stewarded by the people themselves and that it's empowered versus paper parks, then it will work. But otherwise, that's just a target that we're never really going to meet.
Mary, what do you think in Southeast? You've done most of your work in South Asia or Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. And can we set aside? Is it possible to set aside land there, or would you consider it being set aside if it's home to some indigenous communities and there are management plans, et cetera?
I think that it's tricky, of course. But I think it's important to set goals. And I think those goals are really helpful for the global biodiversity framework and to ensure that countries are trying to meet those goals. But I think as we've said, it's more about how we're reaching those goals and who is involved as much as exactly what the number is. And if, as long as at the same time, we're also addressing the underlying drivers, the root causes of biodiversity loss, such as, you know, this pervasive separation of humans from nature, we need to repair our relationship with biodiversity and nature. We need to address the pursuit of continuing economic growth, seemingly without end. And ineffective institutions. You know, we have a lot of other really big issues we need to solve too, that if we don't look at those as well, across sectors, as Viviana was saying, we won't be successful either.
So you feel like unless we solve some of the systemic problems in society globally, we are unlikely to be able to solve some of the natural world problems of loss of species.
That is what I'm saying. Yeah.
Okay. Well, how much of your gazillion dollars do you want to spend on trying to fix systemic problems? And where would you start as it pertains to saving the world's biodiversity?
Yeah, I mean, so let's take an example of what I was saying before. So the huge opportunity of really privileging Indigenous-led efforts. There's a huge systemic challenge there, for example, that would need to be resolved for that to actually work, for me giving my gazillion dollars to that to work, which is that the fact is that conservation endeavors and entities and institutions have done great harm to Indigenous communities and local communities in the name of conservation. And that includes my family members, my Sami family members. And so that harm needs to be addressed. It needs to be recognized and reckoned with in order for these other efforts to be successful. Otherwise, the trust isn't there to as a baseline to work from. So we need to address, as an example of one of the huge systematic issues we need to deal with, is inequality and disempowerment of Indigenous and local communities. And, you know, in some ways, this idea of a direct funding mechanism could help to deal with that. But on top of that, there needs to be recognition and conversations and difficult conversations to build the trust again.
Yeah.
What? I think if I can add to that, mm-hmm. one of the things that we don't invest enough in conservation is governance. And governance is extremely important in addressing a lot of these barriers, because governance really helps a lot of the projects that we're doing with Coastal Solutions includes a whole component on training and a whole component of thinking of the governance structure of your conservation project. You know, who are the decision makers? Who mm-hmm. holds the power? How do you actually transfer that structure so that the people that have the natural capital can have other capital as well and be able to overcome these barriers? So I think investing in governance in order to really empower and transfer not just knowledge, but resources and power to the people who are really coming up with solutions. Because a lot of times it's not, you know, you can teach a whole community to preserve something and then a big company comes in and they don't have the power to say no. And so it's really that governance structure.
It's a great point. You know, so I work in philanthropy with the Overbrook Foundation. And I'm just, as you were talking, I was trying to think about all the foundations that I know, and governance doesn't come up as an area of interest. Maybe because it's complicated, maybe because it's a long-term solution, or maybe because it's systemic. And, you know, so many governments are broken, but not if we look at a more local, a hyper-local mm-hmm. level. That is where we can make the real change, and then it emanates out, right? I'm going to turn the conversation a little bit to the climate crisis and biodiversity. For a while, many years, everyone was talking about the climate crisis, and biodiversity really wasn't getting much attention at all. Which do you think is more important? Would you rather live on a planet with no biodiversity or a major climate crisis? Do you think that you could separate the two?
I think we can't separate the two, and we see them hand in hand. So right now, for example, the mega fires that are happening out west, they're decimating bird populations. And so unless we address the drivers of climate change, we're really not going to preserve biodiversity. And I think now more than ever, we're really seeing that synergy as climate change is knocking on people's doors. It's affecting their livelihoods, and they're starting to think of what is happening to the world around us. And they might have a friendlier ear to the biodiversity crisis that's also being affected, like they are, by climate, the severe droughts that are really impacting livestock, that are impacting a lot of wildlife. I think for the first time, we're starting to see a confluence. What biodiversity has been dealing with, people are starting to deal with more and more. Who have the resources usually is marginalized populations who are, of course, facing the impacts of climate change the most. But now it's coming at people's doors. And so I think we can't separate the two any longer.
Mm-hmm. You know, the first time I brought up climate change in Vietnam, when we were talking about the primate conservation action plan at the national level, there wasn't a whole lot of traction. So, you know, I think they felt there were more urgent concerns, you know, like deforestation, wildlife trade, hunting, et cetera. And I understood that, but I lobbied really hard to make sure climate change was fully recognized as a part of the plan, because we need to start thinking about it. And it didn't take long for them to be fully on board. And now it's a part of the National Biodiversity Strategy. We have funding from various foundations. And I'm actually, in a couple of weeks, I'll be in Vietnam giving a workshop on how to project models of species distributions under climate change for some of the most critically endangered species there, to follow up on the action plan. And yeah, I think there's been kind of a shift. It's really on everybody's mind now. I'm worried it's too little too late. I feel so overwhelmed by this issue. So with my family who are in the Arctic, they have been feeling climate change for a much longer time in their daily lives. And they feel it twice, you know, what we're feeling here. The magnitude of changes are already double what we're feeling, you know, in the lower latitudes and the more global average. Their lives are being lost. Livelihoods are being lost. This is very real. It's very imminent. There's a lot of grief. And so for me, it's it's not just about biodiversity or climate change. It's about human life at this point, and we need to get on it.
Right. I was in Ghana a few months back and visiting with cocoa farmers. And for the first time ever, everyone talked about the climate crisis. I'd never heard farmers really speak that much about it specifically, but they were talking about the dry season is now the rainy season. Everything is unpredictable and more intense, and it's really impacting their livelihoods. And we're trying to help them figure it out. And again, I think what you were saying is that those who had the least to do with the problem are the most affected by it, and that creates a crisis, and it's not going to go away. So you both teach, right? You both have students. What do you tell your students, or if they come up to you, if I raised my hand and said, "What can I do?" As a one person, how can I help? What kind of advice do you give them?
So they always think the flip side of biodiversity loss is biodiversity potential. And I think that's where the conversation is about nature positive. And what I always tell not just my students, but my family in-laws, there's a lot that you can do starting with your own backyard. So, you know, you hear a great horned owl in your yard, but you don't think that when you have pest management control come to get the mice out of your house, if you use bait, the wrong kind of bait, then you actually might be killing that owl. There's just a lot that you can do. A lot of folks spray their yards with insecticides. So I was in Colorado for part of the pandemic, and everybody was spraying for mosquitoes. And we tried to set up our own little garden, and we didn't get a single eggplant. We barely got anything because there were no bees, no insects. And, you know, you're thinking there are a couple of woodpeckers there that whose nestlings all died. And the nest boxes, our neighbors came and said, "I wonder why." It's like, well, the actions that you take in your house, first of all, in your yard, really have an impact cumulatively. But also, I think, in agriculture is one of the biggest potentials ways that we can influence. And so I really tell my students pretty hard about the choices that they make when they buy food, the choices that they make when they look at packaging. You have many, many choices on your data and from one day to another, and you can really you don't have to just buy an electric car. That's, you know, most people can't afford one, but you can really make a lot of small choices in your life. Do you choose bananas that are, you know, laced with pesticides, or you pay 10 more cents, less than the cost to get a IPA? you can really make a difference little by little.
That's great. Mary, what do you think? Yeah. What do you advise?
Yeah, similarly, like, you know, even among my students who are also scientists, and I think the science we do is critical, right? There's a lot we can continue to contribute as scientists in this effort. And additionally, as important is telling our story, engaging in storytelling, and just talking to our families. So I have pretty typical American family that is deeply divided politically in my extended family. And, you know, something we can talk about all the time is food and nature and the things we see out of our yard. And we can find commonalities with each other when we talk about those kind of really central things in our lives. And you can find a lot of common ground with people when you're talking about food and where it comes from, and the huge broken, you know, systems around food. And of course, since you're here, both of you, we have to encourage people to buy shade-grown coffee, of course. That's an easy one.
You can be a better consumer and look for labels like the Rainforest Alliance or Fair Trade to know that, to learn more about the products that you buy. I read an article recently about a fight between a family that was trying to make their backyard more of a natural habitat. They let the grass grow longer. They let different weeds and things grow in there. And the town or their neighbors went to the town and tried to forcibly get them to mow their lawn so it would look like another green lawn. Now, what do we do? How are we going to change the, I mean, I always say that, look, we have all the technological know-how to save the planet, to change the world. What we don't necessarily have now is the will to change. So how does that one family with that trying to do the right thing in their yard convince their neighbors that it's okay what they're doing? In fact, it's a better way.
We need to run for local office, more of us, I think. That's one way. So if you feel passionately about these things, get involved in local politics in your area. We need you.
Very good. Viviana, what do you think?
It is. So I think a lot about how do we convince people of things or how do we influence behavior? And I listen to a lot of other podcasts like Hidden Brain. Evolution of psychology has always interested me because it never is a logical argument that wins. It always, it's something from the heart. It's always emotion. So one of the things that I do, and that's very powerful and that it relates to the coffee work that I do is, you know, close your eyes and what do you think about when you think about your childhood? And a lot of times people remember sounds. And they think of, oh, without even realizing what they're saying, spring and birds are something that they remember of their childhood. They might remember meadowlarks singing. They remember sounds, or for example, they remember a drive up the coast, what that coast looked like. And when you evoke emotion in people, and then you really contrast, well, think of what you hear when you wake up out of your window in your house every day. What do you want your, do you remember, did you ever see a bird nest? Did you ever see wildlife in your yard? Do your kids ever see wildlife in your yard? What is your house? What does your morning sound like? And then you can start kind of like Mary said, finding common ground, but really evoking emotion into this and saying, what I want, what I'm trying to do is this. This is what I hear. This is what I listen. You know,
right?
Do you want me to change that? And that's a different argument.
Yeah, it's really powerful. Okay, I'm going to give away this idea. But I've been thinking that when everyone in the world is born, in addition to their birth certificate, they should be given an earth certificate. And it should have a bird list, a species list, instructions on how to live on this planet, and, you know, environmental education. So they get it from day one, right? Because your point is so right that if we can remind people that we're all connected and give them a pathway, I don't think that it will work unless, for example, the people with the lawns know where to go, and they need solid factual information from an organization or the environmental community that says, here's what you can do, right? We have to, I think as a community, we're failing a little bit because in order to sometimes build our own memberships, we have to come up with our own information, and then it's different from this organization and that one. We have to get together, right? And be a community. And then become a greater community where we care for the planet more. So we're just about out of time. And I wondered if you both had sort of parting thoughts for listeners about either your work or just, gosh, life in general, but as it pertains to working around these really tough issues of conserving biodiversity and solving the climate crisis.
My main advice is always get to know your yard, get to know your outside world, and start listening and exploring. I think one interesting aspect of the pandemic was that more people became birders than at any other point in time. because when the world quieted down, even my own sister said, there's this orange bird nesting on my front porch. It was a robin. It said it wasn't an orange bird, but that's what she called it. But, you know, people started noticing what was around them. And the more that we can engage with the world around us, the more that we start caring. We start caring about that dove that's nesting. What happened to its eggs? Why is it not nesting here anymore, et cetera. And the more that we can really connect with nature again, we will connect with ourselves and we will care more and ideally make better decisions long term.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I would echo that. I think it can be really hard in this field to be really down and disappointed about the direction that everything is going. But there's a lot of reasons for optimism. And those reasons are mostly people and their stories and how we have a critical mass that we've never had before of people who are tuned in to these issues and care. And so now is the time to get involved and act and do more. And I'm excited about that. I'm not totally bummed. I think there is hope. After talking to you, I have even more hope than I did before this conversation.
You know, and I'll just add in, I spent many of the last number of years kind of bummed and depressed, feeling like, oh my gosh, we are in such trouble. But recently I've been working with a cohort of graduate students at Columbia, and they are doing such amazing work in sustainability. And so I decided every time I start to feel depressed about the planet, I go look at the organizations that the Overbrook Foundation is involved with. And I look at the staff list and I just go, oh my gosh, these people are incredible. And there are so many of them. There's, you know, we have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, young people who are changing their lives and want to work in sustainability. And with them, I have hope. And that gives me, you know, that inspires me, but not as much as you both, Viviana and Mary. I love hearing from you both. I could listen to you all day long. I have so much admiration for you. I think if you two could run the country or the world, we would be awesome. So I'm going to be starting your campaigns as soon as we finish this podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time today. You do the most amazing work. I'd love to come work for both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. This was great.
On behalf of the Alliance, thank you for joining us today for this important conversation. It's our hope that sharing these ideas will open new pathways to effective action supporting the fragile world we share. Thanks also to the Americana Foundation for supporting this series. Find us on the web and get involved with our work at AllianceOfLeadershipFellows.org.